and her mother subsequently was often nasty and demeaning to her. At some point, Uta discovered that she could blank out her mind when her mother yelled at her. 35 years later, when she was trapped in her demolished car, Uta's brain automatically went into the same survival mode. She made herself disappear. The challenge for people like Uta is to become alert and engaged. A difficult but unavoidable task if they want to recapture their lives. Uta herself did recover. She wrote a book about her experiences and started a successful journal called Mental Fitness. This is where a bottom-up approach to the therapy becomes essential. The aim is actually to change the patient's physiology, his or her relationship to bodily sensations. At the trauma center, we work with such basic measures as heart rate and breathing patterns. We help patients evoke and notice bodily sensations by tapping acupressure points. Rhythmic interactions with other people are also effective, tossing a beach ball back and forth, bouncing on a Pilates ball, drumming, or dancing to music. Numbing is the other side of the coin to PTSD. Many untreated trauma survivors start out like Stan, with explosive flashbacks, then numb out later in life. While reliving trauma is dramatic, frightening, and potentially self-destructive, over time a lack of presence can be even more damaging. This is a particular problem with traumatized children. The acting out kids tend to get attention. The blanked out ones don't bother anybody and are left to lose their future, bit by bit. Learning to live in the present. The challenge of trauma treatment is not only dealing with the past, but, even more, enhancing the quality of day-to-day experience. One reason that traumatic memories become dominant in PTSD is that it's so difficult to feel truly alive right now. When you can't be fully here, you go to the places where you do feel alive, even if those places are filled with horror and misery. Many treatment approaches for traumatic stress focus on desensitizing patients to their past, with the expectation that re-exposure to their traumas will reduce emotional outbursts and flashbacks. I believe that this is based on a misunderstanding of what happens in traumatic stress. We must, most of all, help our patients to live fully and securely in the present. In order to do that, we need to help bring those brain structures that deserted them when they were overwhelmed by trauma back. Desensitization may make you less reactive, but if you cannot feel satisfaction in ordinary everyday things like taking a walk, cooking a meal, or playing with your kids, life will pass you by. Chapter 5. Body-Brain Connections. Life is about rhythm. We vibrate, our hearts are pumping blood. We are a rhythm machine. That's what we are. Mickey Hart. Toward the end of his career, in 1872, Charles Darwin published The Expression of the Emotions in Man and Animals. Until recently, most scientific discussion of Darwin's theories has focused on the Origin of Species, 1859, and The Descent of Man, 1871. But The Expression of the Emotions turns out to be an extraordinary exploration of the foundations of emotional life, filled with observations and anecdotes drawn from decades of inquiry, as well as close-to-home stories of Darwin's children and household pets. It's also a landmark in book illustration, one of the first books ever to include photographs. Photography was still a relatively new technology, and like most scientists, Darwin wanted to make use of the latest techniques to make his points. It's still in print today, relatively available in a recent edition with a terrific introduction and commentaries by Paul Ekman, a modern pioneer in the study of emotions. Darwin starts his discussion by noting the physical organization common to all mammals, including human beings, the lungs, kidneys, brains, digestive organs, and sexual organs that sustain and continue life. Though many scientists today would accuse him of anthropomorphism, Darwin stands with animal lovers when he proclaims, "Man and the higher animals also have instincts in common. All have the same senses, intuition, sensation, passions, affections, and emotions, even the more complex ones, such as jealousy, suspicion, emulation, gratitude, and magnanimity." He observes that we humans share some of the physical signs of animal emotion. Feeling the hair on the back of your neck stand up when you're frightened, or baring your teeth when you're enraged, can only be understood as vestiges of a long evolutionary process. For Darwin, mammalian emotions are fundamentally rooted in biology. They are the indispensable source of motivation to initiate action. Emotions, from the Latin word emovere, meaning to move out, give shape and direction to whatever we do, and their primary expression is through the muscles of the face and body. These facial and physical movements communicate our mental state and intention to others. Angry expressions and threatening postures caution them to back off. Sadness attracts care and attention. Fear signals helplessness or alerts us to danger. We instinctively read the dynamic between two people simply from their tension or relaxation, their postures and tone of voice, their changing facial expressions. Watch a movie in a language you don't know, and you can still guess the quality of the relationship between the characters. We often can read other mammals, such as monkeys, dogs, and horses, in the same way. Darwin goes on to observe that the fundamental purpose of emotions is to initiate movement that will restore the organism to safety and physical equilibrium. Here is his comment on the origin of what today we would call PTSD. Behaviors to avoid or escape from danger have clearly evolved to render each organism competitive in terms of survival. But inappropriately prolonged escape or avoidance behavior would put the animal at a disadvantage, in that successful species preservation demands reproduction, which in turn depends on feeding, shelter, and mating activities, all of which are reciprocals of avoidance and escape. In other words, if an organism is stuck in survival mode, its energies are focused on fighting off unseen enemies, which leaves no room for nurture, care, and love. For us humans, it means that as long as the mind is defending itself against invisible assaults, our closest bonds are threatened, along with our ability to imagine, plan, play, learn, and pay attention to other people's needs. Darwin also wrote about body-brain connections that we are still exploring today. Intense emotions involve not only the mind, but also the gut and the heart. Darwin wrote, "Heart, guts, and brain communicate intimately via the pneumogastric nerve, the critical nerve involved in the expression and management of emotions in both humans and animals. When the mind is strongly excited, it instantly affects the state of the viscera, so that under excitement, there will be much mutual action and reaction between these, the two most important organs of the body." The first time I encountered this passage, I reread it with growing excitement. Of course we experience our most devastating emotions as gut-wrenching feelings and heartbreak. As long as we register emotions primarily in our heads, we can remain pretty much in control. But feeling as if our chest is caving in or we've been punched in the gut is unbearable. We'll do anything to make these awful, visceral sensations go away, whether it is clinging desperately to another human being, rendering ourselves insensible with drugs or alcohol, or taking a knife to the skin to replace overwhelming emotions with definable sensations. How many mental health problems, from drug addiction to self-injurious behavior, start as attempts to cope with the unbearable physical pain of our emotions? If Darwin was right, the solution requires finding ways to help people alter the inner sensory landscape of their bodies. Until recently, this Bidirectional communication between body and mind was largely ignored by Western science, even as it had long been central to traditional healing practices in many other parts of the world, notably in India and China. Today, it is transforming our understanding of trauma and recovery. A window into the nervous system. All of the little signs we instinctively register during a conversation, the muscle shifts and tensions in the other person's face, eye movements and pupil dilation, pitch and speed of the voice, as well as the fluctuations in our own inner landscape, such as salivation, swallowing, breathing, and heart rate, are linked by a single regulatory system. All are a product of the synchrony between the two branches of the autonomic nervous system, the ANS. The first is the sympathetic, which acts as the body's accelerator, and the second is the parasympathetic, which serves as its brake. These are the reciprocals Darwin spoke of, and working together, they play an important role in managing the body's energy flow, one preparing for its expenditure, the other for its conservation. The sympathetic nervous system, known as the SNS, is responsible for arousal, including the fight-or-flight response, Darwin's escape or avoidance behavior. Almost 2,000 years ago, the Roman physician Galen gave it the name sympathetic because he observed that it functioned with the emotions, sympathos. The SNS moves blood to the muscles for quick action, partly by triggering the adrenal glands to squirt out adrenaline, which speeds up the heart rate and increases blood pressure. The second branch of the ANS is the parasympathetic, meaning against emotions, nervous system, known as the PNS, which promotes self-preservation functions like digestion and wound healing. It triggers the release of acetylcholine to put a brake on arousal, slowing the heart down, relaxing muscles, and returning breathing to normal. As Darwin pointed out, feeding, shelter, and mating activities depend on the PNS. There is a simple way to experience these two systems for yourself. Whenever you take a deep breath, you activate the SNS. The resulting burst of adrenaline speeds up your heart, which explains why many athletes take a few short, deep breaths before starting competition. Exhaling, in turn, activates the PNS, which slows down the heart. If you take a yoga or a meditation class, your instructor will probably urge you to pay particular attention to the exhalation, since deep, long breaths out help calm you down. As we breathe, we continually speed up and slow down the heart. And because of that, the interval between two successive heartbeats is never precisely the same. A measurement called heart rate variability, or HRV, can be used to test the flexibility of this system, and good HRV, the more fluctuation the better, is a sign that the brake and accelerator in your arousal system are both functioning properly and in balance. We had a breakthrough when we acquired an instrument to measure HRV, and I'll explain in Chapter 16 how we can use HRV to help treat PTSD. The Neural Love Code. In 1994, Stephen Porges, who was a researcher at the University of Maryland at the time we started our investigation of HRV, and who is now at the University of North Carolina, introduced the polyvagal theory, which built on Darwin's observations and added another 140 years of scientific discoveries to those early insights. Polyvagal refers to the many branches of the vagus nerve, Darwin's pneumogastric nerve, which connects numerous organs, including the brain, lungs, heart, stomach, and intestines. The polyvagal theory provided us with a more sophisticated understanding of the biology of safety and danger, one based on the subtle interplay between the visceral experiences of our own bodies and the voices and faces of the people around us. It explained why a kind face or a soothing tone of voice can dramatically alter the way we feel. It clarified why knowing that we are seen and heard by the important people in our lives can make us feel calm and safe, and why being ignored or dismissed can precipitate rage reactions or mental collapse. It helped us understand why focused attunement with another person can shift us out of disorganized and fearful states. In short, Porges' theory made us look beyond the effects of fight or flight and put social relationships front and center in our understanding of trauma. It also suggested new approaches to healing that focus on strengthening the body's system for regulating arousal. Human beings are astoundingly attuned to subtle emotional shifts in people and animals around them. Slight changes in the tension of the brow, wrinkles around the eyes, curvature of the lips, and angle of the neck quickly signal to us how comfortable, suspicious, relaxed, or frightened someone is. Our mirror neurons register their inner experience, and our own bodies make internal adjustments to whatever we notice. Just so, the muscles of our own faces give others clues about how calm or excited we feel, whether our heart is racing or quiet, and whether we're ready to pounce on them or run away. When the message we receive from another person is, "You're safe with me," we relax. If we're lucky in our relationships, we also feel nourished, supported, and restored as we look into the face and eyes of the other. Our culture teaches us to focus on personal uniqueness, but at a deeper level, we barely exist as individual organisms. Our brains are built to help us function as members of a tribe. We are part of that tribe even when we are by ourselves, whether listening to music that other people created, watching a basketball game on television, our own muscles tensing as the players run and jump, or preparing a spreadsheet for a sales meeting, anticipating the boss's reactions. Most of our energy is devoted to connecting with others. If we look beyond the list of specific symptoms that entail formal psychiatric diagnoses, we find that almost all mental suffering involves either trouble in creating workable and satisfying relationships, or difficulties in regulating arousal, as in the case of habitually becoming enraged, shut down, overexcited, or disorganized. Usually, it's a combination of both. The standard medical focus on trying to discover the right drug to treat a particular disorder tends to distract us from grappling with how our problems interfere with our functioning as members of our tribe. Safety and reciprocity. A few years ago, I heard Jerome Kagan, a distinguished emeritus professor of child psychology at Harvard, say to the Dalai Lama that for every act of cruelty in this world, there are hundreds of small acts of kindness and connection. His conclusion? To be benevolent rather than malevolent is probably a true feature of our species. Being able to feel safe with other people is probably the single most important aspect of mental health. Safe connections are fundamental to meaningful and satisfying lives. Numerous studies of disaster response around the globe have shown that social support is the most powerful protection against becoming overwhelmed by stress and trauma. Social support is not the same as merely being in the presence of others. The critical issue is reciprocity. Being truly heard and seen by the people around us, feeling that we are held in someone else's mind and heart. For our physiology to calm down, heal, and grow, we need a visceral feeling of safety. No doctor can write a prescription for friendship and love. These are complex and hard-earned capacities. You don't need a history of trauma to feel self-conscious and even panicked at a party with strangers. But trauma can turn the whole world into a gathering of aliens. Many traumatized people find themselves chronically out of sync with the people around them. Some find comfort in groups where they can replay their combat experiences, rape, or torture, with others who have similar backgrounds or experiences. Focusing on a shared history of trauma and victimization alleviates their searing sense of isolation, but usually at the price of having to deny their individual differences. Members can belong only if they conform to the common code. Isolating oneself into a narrowly defined victim group promotes a view of others as irrelevant at best and dangerous at worst, which eventually only leads to further alienation. Gangs, extremist political parties, and religious cults may provide solace, but they rarely foster the mental flexibility needed to be fully open to what life has to offer, and as such, cannot liberate their members from their traumas. Well-functioning people are able to accept individual differences and acknowledge the humanity of others. In the past 2 decades, it has become widely recognized that when adults or children are too skittish or shut down to derive comfort from human beings, relationships with other mammals can help. Dogs and horses, and even dolphins, offer less complicated companionship while providing the necessary sense of safety. Dogs and horses in particular are now extensively used to treat some groups of trauma patients. Three levels of safety. After trauma, the world is experienced with a different nervous system that has an altered perception of risk and safety. Porges coined the word neuroception to describe the capacity to evaluate relative danger and safety in one's environment. When we try to help people with faulty neuroception, the great challenge is finding ways to reset their physiology so that their survival mechanisms stop working against them. This means helping them to respond appropriately to danger, but even more, to recover the capacity to experience safety, relaxation, and true reciprocity. I have extensively interviewed and treated 6 people who survived plane crashes. 2 reported having lost consciousness during the incident. Even though they were not physically injured, they collapsed mentally. 2 went into a panic and stayed frantic until well after we had started treatment. 2 remained calm and resourceful and helped evacuate fellow passengers from the burning wreckage. I found a similar range of responses in survivors of rape, car crashes, and torture. In the previous chapter, we saw the radically different reactions of Stan and Uta as they relived the highway disaster they'd experienced side by side. What accounts for this spectrum of responses? Focused, collapsed, or frantic? Porges' theory provides an explanation. The autonomic nervous system regulates 3 fundamental physiological states. The level of safety determines which one of these is activated at any particular time. Whenever we feel threatened, we instinctively turn to the first level, social engagement. We call out for help, support, and comfort from the people around us. But if no one comes to our aid, or we're in immediate danger, the organism reverts to a more primitive way to survive. Fight or flight. We fight off our attacker, or we run to a safe place. However, if this fails, we can't get away, we're held down or trapped, the organism tries to preserve itself by shutting down and expending as little energy as possible. We are then in a state of freeze or collapse. This is where the many-branched vagus nerve comes in. And I'll describe its anatomy briefly because it's central to understanding how people deal with trauma. The social engagement system depends on nerves that have their origin in the brainstem regulatory centers, primarily the vagus, also known as the 10th cranial nerve, together with adjoining nerves that activate the muscles of the face, throat, middle ear, and voice box or larynx. When the ventral vagal complex, known as the VVC, runs the show, we smile when others smile at us. We nod our heads when we agree, and we frown when friends tell us of their misfortunes. When the VVC is engaged, it also sends signals down to our heart and lungs, slowing down our heart rate and increasing the depth of breathing. As a result, we feel calm and relaxed, centered, or pleasurably aroused. Any threat to our safety or social connections triggers changes in the areas invenerated by the VVC. When something distressing happens, we automatically signal our upset in our facial expressions and tone of voice, changes meant to beckon others to come to our assistance. However, if no one responds to our call for help, the threat increases, and the older limbic brain jumps in. The sympathetic nervous system takes over, mobilizes muscles, heart, and lungs for fight or flight. Our voice becomes faster and more strident. Our heart starts pumping faster. If a dog is in the room, she will stir and growl because she can smell the activation of our sweat glands. Finally, if there's no way out and there's nothing we can do to stave off the inevitable, we will activate the ultimate emergency system, the dorsal vagal complex, the DVC. This system reaches down below the diaphragm to the stomach, kidneys, and intestines, and drastically reduces metabolism throughout the body. Heart rate plunges. We feel our heart drop. We can't breathe, and our gut stops working or empties, literally scaring the shit out of us. This is the point at which we disengage, collapse, and freeze. Fight or flight versus collapse. As we saw in Stan and Uta's brain scans, trauma is expressed not only as fight or flight, but also as shutting down and failing to engage in the present. A different level of brain activity is involved for each response. The mammalian fight or flight system, which is protective and keeps us from shutting down, and the reptilian brain, which produces the collapse response. You can see the difference between these two systems at any big pet store. Kittens, puppies, mice, and gerbils constantly play around, and when they're tired, they huddle together, skin to skin, in a pile. In contrast, the snakes and lizards lie motionless in the corners of their cages, unresponsive to the environment. This sort of immobilization, generated by the reptilian brain, characterizes many chronically traumatized people, as opposed to the mammalian panic and rage that make more recent trauma survivors so frightened and frightening. Almost everyone knows what that quintessential fight-flight response, road rage, feels like. A sudden threat precipitates an intense impulse to move and attack. Danger turns off our social engagement system, decreases our responsiveness to the human voice, and increases our sensitivity to threatening sounds. Yet for many people, panic and rage are preferable to the opposite, shutting down and becoming dead to the world. Activating fight-flight at least makes them feel energized. That's why so many abused and traumatized people feel fully alive in the face of actual danger, while they go numb in situations that are more complex but objectively safe, like birthday parties or family dinners. When fighting or running does not take care of the threat, we activate the last resort, the reptilian brain, the ultimate emergency system. This system is most likely to engage when we are physically immobilized, as when we are pinned down by an attacker, or when a child has no escape from a terrifying caregiver. Collapse and disengagement are controlled by the DVC, an evolutionarily ancient part of the parasympathetic nervous system that is associated with digestive symptoms like diarrhea and nausea. It also slows down the heart and induces shallow breathing. Once this system takes over, other people, and we ourselves, cease to matter. Awareness is shut down, and we may no longer even register physical pain. How we become human. In Porges' grand theory, the VVC evolved in mammals to support an increasingly complex social life. All mammals, including human beings, band together to mate, nurture their young, defend against common enemies, and coordinate hunting and food acquisition. The more efficiently the VVC synchronizes the activity of the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous systems, the better the physiology of each individual will be attuned to that of other members of the tribe. Thinking about the VVC in this way illuminates how parents naturally help their kids to regulate themselves. Newborn babies are not very social. They sleep most of the time and wake up when they're hungry or wet. After having been fed, they may spend a little time looking around, fussing or staring, but they will soon be asleep again, following their own internal rhythms. Early in life, they are pretty much at the mercy of the alternating tides of their sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous systems, and their reptilian brain runs most of the show. But, day by day, as we coo and smile and cluck at them, we stimulate the growth of synchronicity in the developing VVC. These interactions help to bring our baby's emotional arousal systems into sync with their surroundings. The VVC controls sucking, swallowing, facial expressions, and the sounds produced by the larynx. When these functions are stimulated in an infant, they are accompanied by a sense of pleasure and safety, which helps create the foundation for all future social behavior. As my friend Ed Tronick taught me a long time ago, the brain is a cultural organ. Experience shapes the brain. Being in tune with other members of our species via the VVC is enormously rewarding. What begins as the attuned play of mother and child continues with the rhythmicity of a good basketball game, the synchrony of tango dancing, and the harmony of choral singing or playing a piece of jazz or chamber music, all of which foster a deep sense of pleasure and connection. We can speak of trauma when that system fails, when you beg for your life, but the assailant ignores your pleas, when you are a terrified child lying in bed, hearing your mother scream as her boyfriend beats her up, when you see your buddy trapped under a piece of metal that you're not strong enough to lift, when you want to push away the priest who is abusing you, but you're afraid you'll be punished. Immobilization is at the root of most traumas. When that occurs, the DVC is likely to take over. Your heart slows down, your breathing becomes shallow, and zombie-like, you lose touch with yourself and your surroundings. You dissociate, faint, and collapse. Defend or relax. Steve Porges helped me realize that the natural state of mammals is to be somewhat on guard. However, in order to feel emotionally close to another human being, our defensive system must, temporarily, shut down. In order to play, mate, and nurture our young, the brain needs to turn off its natural vigilance. Many traumatized individuals are too hypervigilant to enjoy the ordinary pleasures that life has to offer, while others are too numb to absorb new experiences or to be alert to signs of real danger. When the smoke detectors of the brain malfunction, people no longer run when they should be trying to escape or fight back when they should be defending themselves. The landmark ACE study, which is an acronym for Adverse Childhood Experiences, which I'll discuss in more detail in Chapter 9, showed that women who had an early history of abuse and neglect were 7 times more likely to be raped in adulthood. Women who, as children, had witnessed their mothers being assaulted by their partners had a vastly increased chance to fall victim to domestic violence. Many people feel safe as long as they can limit their social contact to superficial conversations. But actual physical contact can trigger intense reactions. However, as Porges points out, achieving any sort of deep intimacy, a close embrace, sleeping with a mate, and sex, requires allowing oneself to experience immobilization without fear. It is especially challenging for traumatized people to discern when they are actually safe, and to be able to activate their defenses when they are in danger. This requires having experiences that can restore the sense of physical safety, a topic to which we'll return many times in the chapters that follow. new approaches to treatment. If we understand that traumatized children and adults get stuck in fight or flight or in chronic shutdown, how do we help them to deactivate these defensive maneuvers that once ensured their survival? Some gifted people who work with trauma survivors know how to do this intuitively. Steve Gross used to run the play program at the trauma center. Steve often walked around the clinic with a brightly colored beach ball, and when he saw angry or frozen kids in the waiting room, he would flash them a big smile. The kids rarely responded. Then, a little later, he would return and accidentally drop his ball close to where a kid was sitting. As Steve leaned over to pick it up, he'd nudge it gently toward the kid. He'd usually give a half-hearted push in return. Gradually, Steve got a back-and-forth going, and before long, you'd see smiles on both faces. From simple, rhythmically attuned movements, Steve had created a small, safe place where the social engagement system could begin to reemerge. In the same way, severely traumatized people may get more out of simply helping to arrange chairs before a meeting, or joining others in tapping out a musical rhythm on the chair seats, than they would from sitting in those same chairs and discussing the failures in their life. One thing is certain. Yelling at someone who is already out of control can only lead to further dysregulation. Just as your dog cowers if you shout and wags his tail when you speak in a high sing-song, we humans respond to harsh voices with fear, anger, or shutdown, and to playful tones by opening up and relaxing. We simply cannot help but respond to these indicators of safety or danger. Sadly, our educational system, as well as many of the methods that profess to treat trauma, tend to bypass this emotional engagement system and focus instead on recruiting the cognitive capacities of the mind. Despite the well-documented effects of anger, fear, and anxiety on the ability to reason, many programs continue to ignore the need to engage the safety system of the brain before trying to promote new ways of thinking. The last things that should be cut from school schedules are chorus, physical education, recess, and anything else involving movement, play, and joyful engagement. When children are oppositional, defensive, numbed out, or enraged, it's also important to recognize that such bad behavior may repeat action patterns that were established to survive serious threats, even if they are intensely upsetting or off-putting. Porges' work has had a profound effect on how my trauma center colleagues and I organize the treatment of abused children and traumatized adults. It's true that we would probably have developed a therapeutic yoga program for women at some point, given that yoga had proved so successful in helping calm them down and get in touch with their dissociated bodies. We would also have been likely to experiment with a theater program in the Boston inner-city schools, with a karate program for rape survivors called Impact Model Mugging, and with play techniques and body modalities like sensory stimulation that have now been used with survivors around the world. All of these and more will be explored in Part 5. But the polyvagal theory helped us understand and explain why all these disparate, unconventional techniques worked so well. It enabled us to become more conscious of combining top-down approaches to activate social engagement with bottom-up methods to calm the physical tensions in the body. We were more open to the value of other age-old, non-pharmacological approaches to health that have long been practiced outside Western medicine, ranging from breath exercises such as pranayama and chanting, to martial arts like qigong, to drumming and group singing and dancing. All rely on interpersonal rhythms, visceral awareness, and vocal and facial communication, which help shift people out of fight-flight states, reorganize their perception of danger, and increase their capacity to manage relationships. The body keeps score. If the memory of trauma is encoded in the viscera, in heartbreaking and gut-wrenching emotions, in autoimmune disorders and skeletal muscular problems, and if mind-brain-visceral communication is the royal road to emotion regulation? This demands a radical shift in our own therapeutic assumptions. Chapter 6. Losing Your Body, Losing Yourself. Be patient toward all that is unsolved in your heart, and try to love the questions themselves. Live the questions now. Perhaps you will gradually, without noticing it, live along some distant day into the answer. Rainer Maria Rilke, from Letters to a Young Poet. Sherry walked into my office with her shoulders slumped, her chin nearly touching her chest. Even before we spoke a word, her body was telling me that she was afraid to face the world. I also noticed that her long sleeves only partially covered the scabs on her forearms. After sitting down, she told me in a high-pitched monotone that she couldn't stop herself from picking at the skin on her arms and chest until she bled. As far back as Sherry could remember, her mother had run a foster home, and their house was often packed with as many as 15 strange, disruptive, frightened, and frightening kids who disappeared as suddenly as they arrived. Sherry had grown up taking care of these transient children, feeling that there was no room for her and her needs. "I know I wasn't wanted," she told me. "I'm not sure when I first realized that, but I thought about things that my mother said to me, and the signs were always there." She'd tell me, "You know, I don't think you belong in this family. I think they gave us the wrong baby." And she'd say that with a smile on her face. But of course, people often pretend to joke when they say something serious. Over the years, our research team has repeatedly found that chronic emotional abuse and neglect can be just as devastating as physical abuse and sexual molestation. Sherry turned out to be a living example of these findings. Not being seen, not being known, and having nowhere to turn to feel safe is devastating at any age, but it is particularly destructive for young children who are still trying to find their place in the world. Sherry had graduated from college, but she now worked in a joyless clerical job, lived alone with her cats, and had no close friends. When I asked her about men, she told me that her only relationship had been with a man who'd kidnapped her while she was on a college vacation in Florida. He'd held her captive and raped her repeatedly for 5 consecutive days. She remembered having been curled up, terrified, and frozen for most of that time, until she realized she could try to get away. She escaped by simply walking out while he was in the bathroom. When she called her mother, Colette, for help, her mother refused to take the call. Sherry finally managed to get home with assistance from a domestic violence shelter. Sherry told me that she'd started to pick at her skin because it gave her some relief from feeling numb. The physical sensations made her feel more alive, but also deeply ashamed. She knew she was addicted to these actions, but could not stop them. She consulted many mental health professionals before me, and had been questioned repeatedly about her suicidal behavior. She'd also been subjected to involuntary hospitalization by a psychiatrist who refused to treat her unless she could promise that she would never pick at herself again. However, in my experience, patients who cut themselves or pick at their skin, like Sherry, are seldom suicidal, but are trying to make themselves feel better in the only way they know. This is a difficult concept for many people to understand. As I discussed in the previous chapter, the most common response to distress is to seek out people we like and trust to help us and give us the courage to go on. We may also calm down by engaging in a physical activity, like biking or going to the gym. We start learning these ways of regulating our feelings from the first moment someone feeds us when we're hungry, covers us when we're cold, or rocks us when we're hurt or scared. But if no one has ever looked at you with loving eyes or broken out in a smile when she sees you, if no one has rushed to help you but instead said, "Stop crying, or I'll give you something to cry about," then you need to discover other ways of taking care of yourself. You are likely to experiment with anything. Drugs, alcohol, binge eating or cutting, that offers some kind of relief. While Sherry dutifully came to every appointment, it answered my questions with great sincerity. I didn't feel we were making the sort of vital connection that is necessary for therapy to work. Struck by how frozen and uptight she was, I suggested that she see Liz, a massage therapist I had worked with previously. During their first meeting, Liz positioned Sherry on the massage table, then moved to the end of the table and gently held Sherry's feet. Lying there with her eyes closed, Sherry suddenly yelled in a panic, "Where are you?" Somehow, Sherry had lost track of Liz, even though Liz was right there, with her hands on Sherry's feet. Sherry was one of the first patients who taught me about the extreme disconnection from the body that so many people with histories of trauma and neglect experience. I discovered that my professional training, with its focus on understanding and insight, had largely ignored the relevance of the living, breathing body, the foundation of ourselves. Sherry knew that picking her skin was a destructive thing to do, and that it was related to her mother's neglect, but understanding the source of the impulse made no difference in helping her control it.
Losing your body. Once I was alerted to this, I was amazed to discover how many of my patients told me they could not feel whole areas of their bodies. Sometimes I'd ask them to close their eyes and tell me what I had put into their outstretched hands. Whether it was a car key, a quarter, or a can opener, they often could not even guess what they were holding. Their sensory perceptions simply weren't working. I talked this over with my friend Alexander McFarlane in Australia, who had observed the same phenomenon. In his laboratory in Adelaide, he had studied the question, how do we know without looking at it that we're holding a car key? Recognizing an object in the palm of your hand requires sensing its shape, weight, temperature, texture, and position. Each of those distinct sensory experiences is transmitted to a different part of the brain, which then needs to integrate them into a single perception. McFarlane found that people with PTSD often have trouble putting the picture together. When our senses become muffled, we no longer feel fully alive. In an article called What is an Emotion, 1884, William James, the father of American psychology, reported a striking case of sensory insensibility in a woman he interviewed. "I have no human sensations," she told him. "I am surrounded by all that can render life happy and agreeable. Still to me, the faculty of enjoyment and of feeling is wanting. Each of my senses, each part of my proper self, is, as it were, separated from me, and can no longer afford me any feeling. This impossibility seems to depend upon a void which I feel in the front of my head, and to be due to the diminution of the sensibility over the whole surface of my body, for it seems to me that I never actually reach the objects which I touch. All this would be a small matter enough, but for its frightful result, which is that of the impossibility of any other kind of feeling and of any sort of enjoyment, although I experience a need and desire of them that render my life an incomprehensible torture." This response to trauma raises an important question. How can traumatized people learn to integrate ordinary sensory experiences so that they can live with the natural flow of feeling and feel secure and complete in their bodies? How do we know we're alive? Most early neuroimaging studies of traumatized people were like those we've seen in Chapter 3. They focused on how subjects reacted to specific reminders of the trauma. Then in 2004, my colleague Ruth Lanius, who scanned Stan and Uta Lawrence's brains, posed a new question. What happens in the brains of trauma survivors when they are not thinking about the past? Her studies on the idle brain, the Default State Network, known as DSN, opened up a whole new chapter in understanding how trauma affects self-awareness, specifically sensory self-awareness. Dr. Lanius recruited a group of 16 normal Canadians to lie in a brain scanner while thinking about nothing in particular. This is not easy for anyone to do. As long as we are awake, our brains are churning. But she asked them to focus their attention on their breathing and try to empty their minds as much as possible. She then repeated the same experiment with 18 people who had histories of severe, chronic childhood abuse. What is your brain doing when you have nothing in particular on your mind? It turns out that you pay attention to yourself. The default state activates the brain areas that work together to create your sense of self. When Ruth looked at the scans of her normal subjects, she found activation of the DSN regions that previous researchers had described. I like to call this the Mohawk of self-awareness, the midline structures of the brain, starting out right above our eyes, running through the center of the brain all the way to the back. All these midline structures are involved in our sense of self. The largest bright region at the back of the brain is the posterior cingulate, which gives us a physical sense of where we are, our internal GPS. It is strongly connected to the medial prefrontal cortex, or MPFC, the watchtower I discussed in Chapter 4. This connection doesn't show up on the scan because the fMRI can't measure it. It is also connected with brain areas that register sensations coming from the rest of the body. The insula, which relays messages from the viscera to the emotional centers, the parietal lobes, which integrate sensory information, and the anterior cingulate, which coordinates emotions and thinking. All of these areas contribute to consciousness. The contrast with the scans of the 18 chronic PTSD patients with severe early life trauma was startling. There was almost no activation of any of the self-sensing areas of the brain. The MPFC, the anterior cingulate, the parietal cortex, and the insula did not light up at all. The only area that showed a slight activation was the posterior cingulate, which is responsible for basic orientation in space. There could be only one explanation for such results. In response to the trauma itself, and in coping with the dread that persisted long afterward, these patients had learned to shut down the brain areas that transmit the visceral feelings and emotions that accompany and define terror. Yet, in everyday life, those same brain areas are responsible for registering the entire range of emotions and sensations that form the foundation of our self-awareness, our sense of who we are. What we witnessed here was a tragic adaptation. In an effort to shut off terrifying sensations, they also deadened our capacity to feel fully alive. The disappearance of medial prefrontal activation could explain why so many traumatized people lose their sense of purpose and direction. I used to be surprised by how often my patients asked me for advice about the most ordinary things, and then by how rarely they followed it. Now, I understood that their relationship with their own inner reality was impaired. How could they make decisions or put any plan into action if they couldn't define what they wanted or, to be more precise, what the sensations in their bodies, the basis of all emotions, were trying to tell them? The lack of self-awareness in victims of chronic childhood trauma is sometimes so profound that they cannot recognize themselves in a mirror. Brain scans show that this is not the result of mere inattention. The structures in charge of self-recognition may be knocked out, along with the structures related to self-experience. When Ruth Lanius showed me her study, a phrase from my classical high school education came back to me. The mathematician Archimedes, teaching about the lever, is supposed to have said, "Give me a place to stand, and I will move the world." Or, as the great 20th century body therapist Moshe Feldenkrais put it, "You can't do what you want till you know what you're doing. The implications are clear. To feel present, you have to know where you are and to be aware of what is going on with you. If the self-sensing system breaks down, we need to find ways to reactivate it. The self-sensing system. It was fascinating to see how much Sherry benefited from her massage therapy. She felt more relaxed and adventurous in her day-to-day life, and she was also more relaxed and open with me. She became truly involved in her therapy and was genuinely curious about her behavior, thoughts, and feelings. She stopped picking at her skin, and when summer came, she started to spend evenings sitting outside on her stoop, chatting with her neighbors. She even joined a church choir, a wonderful experience of group synchrony. It was at about this time that I met Antonio Damasio at a small think tank that Dan Schachter, the chair of the psychology department at Harvard, had organized. In a series of brilliant scientific articles and books, Damasio clarified the relationship among body states, emotions, and survival. A neurologist who has treated hundreds of people with various forms of brain damage, he became fascinated with consciousness and with identifying the areas of the brain necessary for knowing what you feel. He has devoted his career to mapping out what is responsible for our experience of self. The Feeling of What Happens is, for me, his most important book, and reading it was a revelation. Damasio starts by pointing out the deep divide between our sense of self and the sensory life of our bodies. As he poetically explains it, sometimes we use our minds not to discover facts, but to hide them. One of the things the screen hides most effectively is the body, our own body, by which I mean the ends of it, its interiors. Like a veil thrown over the skin to secure its modesty, the screen partially removes from the mind the inner states of the body, those that constitute the flow of life as it wanders in the journey of each day. He goes on to describe how this screen can work in our favor by enabling us to attend to pressing problems in the outside world, yet it has a cost. It tends to prevent us from sensing the possible origin and nature of what we call self. Building on the century-old work of William James, Damasio argues that the core of our self-awareness rests on the physical sensations that convey the inner states of the body. He writes, "Primordial feelings provide a direct experience of one's own living body, wordless, unadorned, and connected to nothing but sheer existence. These primordial feelings reflect the current state of the body along varied dimensions, along the scale that ranges from pleasure to pain, and they originate at the level of the brainstem rather than the cerebral cortex. All feelings of emotion are complex, musical variations on primordial feelings." Our sensory world takes shape even before we are born. In the womb, we feel amniotic fluid against our skin. We hear the faint sounds of rushing blood and a digestive tract at work. We pitch and roll with our mother's movements. After birth, physical sensation defines our relationship to ourselves and to our surroundings. We start off being our wetness, hunger, satiation, and sleepiness. A cacophony of incomprehensible sounds and images presses in on our pristine nervous system. Even after we acquire consciousness and language, our bodily sensing system provides crucial feedback on our moment-to-moment condition. Its constant hum communicates changes in our viscera and in the muscles of our face, torso, and extremities that signal pain and comfort, as well as urges such as hunger and sexual arousal. What is taking place around us also affects our physical sensations. Seeing someone we recognize, hearing particular sounds, a piece of music, a siren, or sensing a shift in temperature, all change our focus of attention and, without our being aware of it, prime our subsequent thoughts and actions. As we have seen, the job of the brain is to constantly monitor and evaluate what is going on within and around us. These evaluations are transmitted by chemical messages in the bloodstream and electrical messages in our nerves, causing subtle or dramatic changes throughout the body and brain. These shifts usually occur entirely without conscious input or awareness. The subcortical regions of the brain are astoundingly efficient in regulating our breathing, heartbeat, digestion, hormone secretion, and immune